Okay. So you'll see I'll be wearing this little microphone. They produce almost useless recordings of the lecture, but if you ever want to pick up on something I said, you missed a class, you want to show your friends how stupid your prof is, you should be able to go online and get a copy of this lecture or the lecture that follows it. So the way the class will typically be set up is I'll try and put on this board here a review of what we did the previous day. And that'll be particularly useful, I think, when we're doing the first in-class quizzes. I think the first one is scheduled for Friday. Because for those, they're supposed to cover the material that was on the previous exam, or the previous class period, and you probably haven't memorized those equations yet, but they'll be sitting there on the board for you to use. So there are some things here that we didn't talk about. So that there's stuff in Appendix A that deals with kind of basic mathematical parameters that you may remember from high school. Things like that the circumference of a circle is 2 pi r, and the radius, or excuse me, and the area of a circle is pi r squared. So you can find all of that sort of stuff in Appendix A. So the particular things I'm pointing out today are this table that has the areas and circumferences and volumes of kind of standard geometric figures, and the quadratic equation. None of the problems that we've had so far rely on knowing the quadratic equation, but we'll probably have some problems as time goes on that do have us using the quadratic equation. Okay, so most of what we did last time, I bet, is review. So you can't have taken a science course before and not have been introduced to the metric system and these standard multipliers, which you really should memorize and be familiar with. So we've got giga for a billion, mega for a million, kilo for a thousand, milli for a thousandth, micro for a millionth, and nano for a billionth. And there are zillions more, but those are the common ones. The one that occurs that isn't in this list of powers of three that we're going to be using a lot is a centimeter, which is a hundredth of a meter. And you don't see really centa anything else except meters. So that's why I've kind of singled it out as being a little bit different from the rest. We've got scientific notation, where we give a number times a power of 10. It's a great way of giving the number of significant digits. The rule for stuff that you turn in this room is that I always want to see three significant digits. You know that there are various rules, but they're just, I know you can't read this, they're hard to apply because people like to write problems with even numbers. You know, like 60 kilometers per hour in this particular problem. And that, I hope you know we for sure want more than one significant digit probably on this problem. So I think the general rule is to ignore the more or less correct rules for sig figs that are in the book, and instead always use three sig figs for stuff that you turn in this room. Dimension checks. That might not have been familiar to you because, I don't know, really physics is the discipline that has lots of equations in it, and the important thing is that the units of those equations have to work out. You can't have, you know, for example, a formula that says that the speed of a sailboat is 6.2 times the square root of the length of the sailboat because the units just don't work out. That can't be a correct formula. The formulas we're going to be dealing with in this class are correct equations, and their dimensions have to check out. And be good practice to check out the dimensions of every equation that we deal with. Unfortunately, we live in basically the only country in the world that doesn't use the metric system, and so we have to learn a little bit about unit conversion. So for unit conversion, the basic story is you have to multiply by 1, where 1 is written in a fancy way. So for example, 1 kilogram is exactly equal to 1,000 grams, and so the ratio of 1 kilogram to 1,000 grams has to be exactly 1. It has the nice property that the gram unit itself cancels out. And if I want to get rid of kilograms, I know that 2.2 pounds weighs, or 1 kilogram weighs 2.2 pounds. Now it's a little bit tricky with things like cubic centimeters, because that's a centimeter cubed, so I have to use this conversion factor that a meter is 3.28 feet 3 times, so I have to cube that. So I end up with this particular case that a cubic foot of water weighs 62 pounds. More commonly, we deal with gallons for liquid measure in this country. Incidentally, there are imperial gallons in England, but they don't even deal with that anymore. And I guess Canada still maybe has a little bit of imperial gallons left. In any case, the American gallon takes about 7.5 of them to make a cubic foot. So we end up with 8.33 pounds per gallon, right? A pint's a pound the world around, at least approximately so. What I think is going to give you the most problem and is going to come up again and again and again in this class is trigonometry. Because you probably haven't needed to use your trigonometry in your chemistry classes or your biology classes, but we'll be doing a lot of it in this class. So if we have a right triangle and a particular angle, then the side that's opposite we call the opposite, the side that's adjacent we call the adjacent, and the one that goes on the slant we call the hypotenuse. Since triangles are similar if they have the same angles, the ratio of these sides is going to be the same for any triangle that has those same angles. So we can record those numbers in books and in our calculator. And the ratio of the opposite to the hypotenuse, that's what we mean by the sine of theta. Incidentally, most commonly we use this formula the other way around. That is to say, we know the hypotenuse and we multiply it by the sine of theta to get the opposite side. But the definition is that it has to do with the ratio of sides. Typically, unless somebody says otherwise, what we mean by an angle is an angle measured counterclockwise from the positive x-axis. And the best thing is to draw your own picture so I know what theta is. But if you don't draw me a picture, that's what I have to assume what you mean by theta. So draw a picture and then everyone is clear about what the angle is. Questions from last time? So we had a to-do list. Do people have problems doing this to-do list? So we wanted you to sign up for a Moodle page for your lab. We're not going to be using it for the class. You needed to do the pre-lab. Or excuse me, did I say pre-lab? The pre-test. Right, so that's off the class webpage. And lab one, neither of these two things are really due today. This thing is due at midnight tonight. You probably don't have to sign up for the Moodle until you actually take a lab. We're mostly using that just as an online grade book so that you can remember what your grades are for all your labs. And look it up. Questions or problems with any of that stuff? So I'll remind you for lab one, you can take that as many times as you want to get as good a grade as you want. And it's almost as many times as you want, I think, for WebAssign. It's maybe 20 times. It's a huge number of times. And I'd probably add to that if you really want me to. But I think I picked a big enough number that it shouldn't matter. Is it 10? I'll change it to 20. 10 is big, but I think it should be a little bit more than 10. More questions? I see people, incidentally, you know, it's kind of unfortunate on this thing just guessing one thing after another, right? You can get the multiple choice questions correct if you're just diligent enough. Try every possible combination. And people do, right? It's okay. So the topic for today is these terms, position, velocity, and acceleration. But what's going on here is really more general. So I'd like to start in something that has nothing to do with position, velocity, and acceleration, and it might be familiar with you from your other courses. And let's take a look at what we mean by reaction rate. So you can imagine some sort of chemical reaction where you're producing some product, and we could plot the number of moles of that product that are being produced with time. Right, so when we just mix the stuff together, of course, there's none of the product. As time goes on, we're going to be building up some of our product. Now, the way chemical reactions work is as the reactants are used up, the rate is going to be smaller. So kind of typically, the sort of rate of reaction might look kind of like that. So what would we mean by the rate of the reaction? Well, I think it's pretty clear we're talking about the number of moles that are produced per second. But depending upon where we choose our points, we're going to get different values for that rate. Right? So if I choose this point and this point, and I look at the rise, that is to say, these many moles were produced in this much time, and I look at that ratio, moles per second, if you think about it, that's the same thing as the slope of the line that goes through those two points, which is called the secant line. Not that we really care about that. Now, if we want the initial rate of reactions, I think it's pretty clear what we want to do is move this point closer and closer and closer to time equals zero. Now, practically, that becomes difficult, right? Because if we try to figure out how many moles were produced in the first microsecond, we probably couldn't measure those very few number of moles. But theoretically, if we could measure them, we could still look at the number of moles that are produced in a particular time. Now, I'm using this symbol capital delta to indicate the change in. Okay, so what I might mean by the instantaneous rate of the reaction would be the say at this point here, would be the slope of the so-called tangent line that kind of kisses the curve at exactly one point. So the instantaneous rate of reaction is going to be the slope of the tangent line. Okay, so my guess is that this is all pretty familiar stuff. Let me write this a little bit differently. So what we have here is that the rate is the change in the moles, change in the time. I might call this the average rate. The instantaneous rate, what I want to do is to bring the two points that I'm using to measure the change in moles as close together as I can. So that's usually mathematically denoted as a limit as we bring the two points very close together in time of this ratio, the little bit of moles that are produced in that little bit of time. As I say, practically speaking, you can't really let that time go to zero. You have to have a finite time to actually measure a number of moles that are produced. But from a mathematician's point of view, we could actually take the limit of that little bit of time going to zero. Okay? So if you just think about what this is going to mean, if we plot the rate of reaction versus time, you can see that this thing starts out with a pretty big slope, and as time goes on, it's having a smaller and smaller slope. So if we were to graph at any instant what the rate of reaction looks like, it might look kind of like that. It's getting smaller with time. How many moles are produced in the time, some little time interval delta t? Well, we can just rearrange this equation, right? If we take the rate of the reaction times delta t, that's going to be the little bit of moles that were produced as we went from this time to that time. And we can make a geometrical interpretation of this fact, right? Because if we think about it geometrically, this interval represents the base of a rectangle who has a height that is equal to the rate of the reaction. So the area of this rectangle sounds funny, the area of this rectangle is the number of moles that were produced during this time. Now, if I add up the number of moles that are made in the next interval, and I add these two things together, I'm of course going to get the total number of moles that were made from this point to that point. And so it goes. So the upshot of this is the area under the curve, the rate of reaction curve, that's equal to the number of moles that were made from one side of the area to the other side of the area. So if we think about that, we start out with the area under just a point and that's zero. As time goes on, there's more and more and more and more area under this curve, and that corresponds to having more and more and more moles being produced in our reaction. Okay? So it's going to be exactly the same thing, except instead of talking about number of moles, we're going to be talking about the position. The rate at which the position changes, the change in position, change in time, that's what we mean by the velocity. If this change in time is some, you know, noticeable time increment, say 3 minutes or something like that, then we're talking about an average velocity. If we actually take the limit of two very close together points, again, practically that's basically impossible, but mathematicians don't have a problem with that, then we're talking about the instantaneous velocity. This process, I bet almost all of you know, is really the process of taking a derivative. And so if you've taken some calculus, if we have x as a function of time, then we can take the derivative of it and get the velocity. Kind of fancier notation for the derivative is dx dt. And what you should be kind of seeing is that the delta is becoming a d. We think about d's as being particularly small increments, so-called instantaneous time separations. In lab, we'll be dealing with lowercase deltas, which usually indicate also some sort of small change, but we'll use capital deltas to indicate kind of finite changes, and these d's to indicate kind of instantaneous changes. Okay, so if we make a graph of position versus time, and we make a graph of velocity versus time, then the slope of this curve, you can see this slope is getting less and less and less, tells us what the velocity is. So to go from position to velocity, we need to take the slope. To go from velocity to position, works just like it did here, all we need to do is look at the area under the curve. Okay, so velocity is the rate of change of position. And almost all velocities are going to be instantaneous velocities in this course, but kind of for this one chapter, we're going to be talking about average velocities. Well, acceleration has to do with changing velocity. So we can do exactly the same thing, right? So we can say that the acceleration is the change in the velocity divided by the change in time. And we can talk about an average acceleration if we're looking at big differences in time. We can talk about an instantaneous acceleration if we're actually letting the 2 points that we're averaging approach each other. So once again, we can make a graph of acceleration versus time. And if we're going to go from this thing here, oops, okay, have to change this around a little bit, because this has a constant negative slope. So there's zero. and there's my acceleration value. Right, so to go from velocity to acceleration, I need to take the slope, whereas to go from acceleration to, really ugly graph. So this is acceleration, this is the 0 point, and this thing has a negative slope, so I better draw the acceleration as being less than 0. To go the other way, I want to look at the area under the curve. And again, those of you who have had some calculus know that the area under the curve, the fancy name for that is the integral. And it's usually denoted by this thing that looks like that. It's actually supposed to remind you of the letter S. And integral and differentiation are opposite functions. Right? So we can take the derivative of this. We can take the slope of this to get the velocity, and then we can look at the integral of it to get the area and get back. Okay. Well, let's, just kind of, so here's a graph of position versus time, and we'll maybe hold off on it in a minute, but let's just try and see what that means. So we start at a position that is 10, and we go back through 0 until we reach a position that is 30. And then we go forward again, passing 0, and in the end, we're going to end up going to some sort of 30 point. Right? So this is a case where we move backwards, and then we move forwards. So I hope it's clear that, for example, the velocity at A is negative, right? And the velocity at B, I'm turning around, right? I was going backwards, and I started to go forwards at B. So right at that instant B, I had to have 0 velocity. At C, of course, my velocity is positive. I'm moving forward. And if this thing is flat at the top, it looks to me like it is flat at the top, then the velocity at D is again 0. Okay. So I don't know. Let's do some card work. Ooh, maybe it's going to be too big. So the story is that starting from rest, a car accelerates down a straight road. Short time later, the car applies the brakes and the car comes to a stop. Which of these graphs displays this position versus time, right? So the story is we start from rest, we accelerate for a while, and we stop. Which one of these graphs best displays that behavior? Unanimous so far. Yeah. So I see A's and C's. One of them's right. One of them's wrong, right? It has to be that way. So there's something that got big for a while and stopped. And that sure sounds like C, right? But what happened was a finite displacement, right? We started at x equals 0, and we stopped at x equals, 60 in this case. So it can't be C, because that's motion that you started at 0, and you returned to 0. So the answer's got to be A. Okay, so in this case here, the problem is that a boy throws something straight up and it comes straight down. Which one of these graphs, these are all graphs of velocity versus time, display that behavior? there's a lot of disagreement. I think I see majority A's, but I see every answer represented. So A is there for you to lose points on. Because there's certainly something in this that looks like it got big and stopped and then got small. Started out big, stopped, and then got small again. But if you think about it, for example, remember that the position would be the area under that curve, which is all positive. So something that is doing that is going to end up down the road. So if the car were doing A, it would be kind of like this. It would have a positive velocity for a while, it would stop, and it would have a positive velocity again in the future. So it would have traversed some area. So if something comes up and comes down, then the area under that curve has to be zero, right? Net net, because the position change is zero. Right, so something like C, for example, it's something that has a positive velocity for a while and then has a negative velocity for a while. And I think that matches more the thing going up or down. So how about B? Well, we haven't talked about it, but it turns out that something that is being thrown has a constant slope, has a constant acceleration. This thing has a changing acceleration because the velocity versus time has a changing slope, and that doesn't work. Okay. So let's say we have motion that the car, I think this was actually on the pretest. The car starts at the origin and it goes forward for a while and then it comes back to where it was originally. Puts on its brakes, comes back. Which one of these guys are going to be the, these things have been through the wars, it sure looks like. Which one of these best represents that motion? Right, so the motion is car starts at zero, comes back to zero. So I see D's and B's. Oh, I see an A too. So let's talk about A first. So if A were correct, let's follow that motion. So it goes positive for a while, goes negative for a while, and then it comes back to zero, right? So this part here, the position is actually negative. So that doesn't match, right? So it can't be A. The motion should all be in the positive x direction, so it's got to be one of B, C, or D. Now, C ends up down the road from where it started, so it can't be C, and this is where I think most of you were, on B and D. So what's the difference? Well, the difference is whether the acceleration is constant or not, right? So we have a constant positive acceleration followed by a constant negative acceleration in the case of B, whereas D starts with zero velocity, reaches a maximum, stops, and then goes back. And I think the motion I showed started with zero velocity as opposed to some finite velocity, so I think D is the right answer. Okay, so here we have a motion that is, you know, kind of like a yo-yo. It's going up and down and up and down and up and down. At least if we're thinking that this is a plot of position versus time. So if this is a plot of position versus time and this is the point we're talking about, is x positive, zero, or negative? So I see A's and B's, no C's. So the origin is here, right? And we can just read off, you know, whatever that distance is, that's what the x value is. So x is starting at 0, reaches some maximum, and it's getting smaller, but it's not 0 yet. So x is positive at this point. At some future point, it'll be 0, and after that, it'll go negative. But right now, x is positive. How about the velocity? What's the velocity at P? Positive, negative? So nobody's opting for 0 that I see, but I still see a good number of both A's and C's. I'd hesitate to say what the majority is. I think the majority is C, but it's pretty close. So you remember that velocity is the slope of that line, right? So in the beginning, x is getting more and more and more, and we've got a positive slope to that line. Then x reaches some maximum value where the velocity is 0, and now we're going back to the origin. So we've got a negative slope to that line. So the velocity at that point is going to be negative. How can we tell the acceleration from this curve? Well, there's a cute theorem. It's called the Smile theorem. And it says that the acceleration is positive if the shape of the curve basically looks like that. And the acceleration is negative if the shape of the curve is basically like that. Right? Should be easy to remember. So pretty clear at P, we're looking at a negative acceleration. So why is this the case? Well, so here, if you think about that as a graph, we're getting faster at a faster rate. The velocity is increasing, 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 and increasing velocity corresponds to positive acceleration. Whereas here, we're going fast initially, but we're slowing down. So if the velocity change is negative, then we have negative acceleration. Right? So deacceleration, all that means is that the acceleration is less than 0, that it's negative. Okay, same graph, but now I'm thinking about that this is a graph of velocity versus time. Is the position positive, negative, or 0 if this is a graph of velocity versus time? So position isn't graph there, right? It's velocity. So we have to somehow or other figure out what the position would have to be if that's what the velocity is. Increasing no-shows. So remember, the position is the area under that curve. And so if we calculate the area under that curve, it's some positive number, right? All of that positive area. But the stuff that's under the x equals 0, that counts as negative area. Okay, so this thing has been moving in the positive direction for some time. It slowed down a little bit, but it's still going in the positive direction. Right? So if we were to do this with a car, started out going to this way, it slowed down a little bit, but it's even still going this way. So the distance it's traveled is a positive number. How about the velocity at that point? Positive, negative, or 0? So I see majority A's, I see some C's. So I think the people who are thinking C are thinking that the velocity is the slope of this curve. That is negative. But this is itself, I'm now saying that this curve is itself a graph of velocity versus time. So I can just read this off directly. This distance is the velocity, and that's some positive number, right? If the point P were here, the velocity would be negative. How about the acceleration at point P? Positive, negative, or zero? So acceleration is the change in velocity with time. It's the slope of this curve, and the slope at that point is negative. Well, maybe a different sort of question. So here's a graph of velocity versus time. Ooh, boy. Really needs to be cleaned. Here's a graph of velocity versus time. At what time did the particle reach its maximum position? So this is a graph of velocity versus time. At what time did the particle reach its maximum position? I think every answer I see is right. Maybe some problems, which is good. So let's kind of graph out what this thing looks like. So this thing actually starts with a positive velocity there at time equals zero, and it's still going in the positive direction at B. It's slowing down when it reaches C, and beyond C it's going negative velocity, right? So the point where it reached its maximum position was there at C, right? When it went from going forward to going backwards. Now, if you remember your calculus, you might remember that you maximize functions by setting the derivative equal to zero. Remember that the velocity is the derivative of the position function, so when the velocity is zero, we have to have reached a maximum possibility. Which case has A, B, or C, or D has the maximum acceleration? Majority is ruling on this one. So remember that acceleration, if we're talking about velocity, to get the acceleration we need to look at the slope. So the slope starts out having zero slope, right? It reaches some big slope, and then it has again zero slope, and then it starts having negative slopes. And of course, negative numbers are smaller than positive numbers. So the biggest slope is there at A, right? Biggest positive slope. Okay, so we can have lots of these sorts of, usually they're called conceptual questions. And if you've looked at old exams, you'll see that my exams typically have 10, 12 of these kind of multiple choice conceptual questions. So these are not like the multiple choice questions that are in WebAssign, which almost always you need a calculator for. So you didn't need a calculator for any of these. And mostly you shouldn't be using a calculator on my multiple choice questions. But the other parts of the exams are typically problems, like the WebAssign problems. So let's take a look at some problems from the book. So I'm thinking about 6, 17, 23, and 6, 17, 23, and 15. And it's pretty unlikely that you're able to read it, but someplace here. Okay, so problem 6 has this graph on it, and it's a graph of position versus time. And they've made it simple for us. These things all have nice straight lines. Straight lines have a constant slope, so all of these things have constant instantaneous velocities. And they want us to calculate the average velocity at various intervals. So first thing we're supposed to do is to calculate the average velocity between time equals 0 and time equals 2. And for that, we have to read this graph. Right? So at time equals, so if I make a plot of time versus position, at time equals 0, the position is 0. And at time equals 2, the position is, looks to me like 10. So the average velocity, and again, I kind of warn you that this distinction between average and instantaneous, it's pretty much just a chapter 2 thing. Everything else we're going to be talking about in this class is going to be pretty much instantaneous velocities. But the average velocity is the change in position divided by the change in time. And again, what this symbol means, change in, I want the final x position, which is the position at time equals 2, minus the position at time equals 0 during this time interval, which is 2 minus 0 or 2 seconds. So what I've got then is 10 minus 0 meters divided by 2 seconds, which is 5 meters a second. Now, on a problem like this, which is so obviously integer-based, you don't have to write, I won't take off any points if you don't write that as 5.00. Right? It's pretty clear that that's not really what's intended by the problem. Okay, so then we're supposed to figure out what the average velocity is when it's going from 0 to 4. And if I read 4, it looks like x is equal to 5 meters. So it's the same sort of story, except now I want to compare the position at time equals 4 to the position at time equals 0. And the position at time equals 4 is 5 meters. So instead of getting 5, I'm going to get 2.5 meters per second. Half of 5, yes? 5/4. Thank you. Stupid. Let me leave this here and write the other one. Okay, so from 4 to 7 seconds. Well, so at 7 seconds, I think the position is supposed to be minus 5 meters. So again, if I do this process, I take x at time equals 7, and I subtract x at time equals 4, and the time separation is 3 seconds. So what I've got is minus 5 minus 5 divided by 3. So I've got it's going backwards in that region, so it's no surprise we're getting a negative number. So I've got minus 10/3, right, or minus 3.33 meters per second. What's the average velocity going from 0 to 8? 0, right? Because the change in position is 0 divided by 8 seconds is 0 every time. Okay, so here we're dealing with average velocities. If we look ahead to the next problem, right, 17, we're supposed to do the same thing, except now we're supposed to be looking at instantaneous velocities. So the instantaneous velocities are the slopes of these lines. So we're going to be interested in the slope at 1 second, at 3 seconds, at 4.5 seconds, and at 7.5 seconds. Okay, so here's the graph. What is the instantaneous velocity at time equals 1? Yeah, it's going to be exactly the same, right? Because if we have a straight line, then the slope is the same every place, and the average slope is the same as that. So we could just take any two points we wanted to on that line, and we could find the slope by taking the rise over the run. Okay, so the average velocity is the same as the instantaneous velocity if you're going at the same speed all the time. Right, so if you're traveling 60 miles an hour for an hour, your average speed is 60 miles an hour, and your instantaneous speed at any time is 60 miles an hour. Okay, so then at 3 seconds, so this is 3 seconds. What's the instantaneous velocity at 3 seconds? You can do that faster than I can. So since this is a straight line, the slope any place is the slope every place, and we can just find the slope of that any old place. And if we use 2 and 4 as our data points, then it's come back 5 meters. So in the numerator, we're going to have the position at time equals 4, which is 5, minus the position at time equals 2, which is 10. We're going to have minus 5 in the numerator. In the denominator, we're going to have 2. So we've got minus 2.5. Okay? What's the instantaneous velocity at 4.5 seconds? 0, right? Because the position isn't changing, and the slope of something that's not changing is 0. Okay. 23. So this is a kind of a more numerical question. A car is capable of accelerating at a rate of 0.6 meters per second squared. Let's take a second to look at what the units are going to be. We haven't talked about the units of acceleration. So an acceleration is a change in velocity divided by a change in time. So it's going to be meters per second per second, which is meters per second squared. So the acceleration of this car is 0.6 meters per second squared. How long does it take this car to go from 55 miles an hour to 60 miles an hour? Okay, so we know, if we kind of rearrange this equation, the change in velocity is going to be the acceleration times the change in time. Or the time is going to be the change in velocity divided by the acceleration. So the acceleration is, it's going from 55 to 60, so it's a positive acceleration. The change in velocity is 5 miles per hour, and the acceleration is 0.6 meters per second squared. So this is exactly where unit conversion starts to crop up, right? Because right now the units of that are terrible. We want to get an answer that's in seconds. And if we go through the process, and we will in a second, of converting miles per hour into meters per second, then what we'll have is meters per second divided by meters per second squared. So the meters are going to go away, and one of those seconds are going to go away. So we'll have 1/1 second, which is a second. We'll have the right units. Okay, so how do we convert 5 miles an hour into meters a second? Well, it's exactly that sort of process. So we've got 5 miles per hour. And I know an hour has 60 minutes, and every minute has 60 seconds. So I know that in 1 hour, there are 60 squared, which is 3,600 seconds. And I know, basically because I worked this problem before I came to class, I wouldn't normally know that 1 mile is 1609 meters. I know it's about a meter. I know I know that it takes roughly a kilometer and a half to make a mile, but I certainly would have to look that number up. So if I crank all of that out on my calculator, I've got five, and want to divide it by 3600 and multiply it by 1609. And I get that the velocity here is 2.23. Hours go away, miles go away. What I'm left with is meters per second. So all I have to do is divide that by 0.6, and I get 3.72 seconds. Okay. Let's take a look at 15. So 15 kind of involves wherever it is. Oh, here it is. It's not, I can't read that number. 15 involves a little bit of algebra for us to work through. So it says that a race car is going to go, needs to average 250 kilometers per hour on a track that is just 600 meters long. And at the halfway point, it has an average speed of 230 kilometers an hour. So it's not going fast enough for the first half. What average speed does it have to have in the second half in order to qualify? Okay, so, I don't know, words to pictures is, I think, the helpful thing to do. And, you know, your pictures may vary. So I'm going to draw a picture of this track that is 600 meters long and with its halfway point. And what I'm told is that in the first half, it averaged, make sure I've got the units right, 250 kilometers an hour, 230 kilometers an hour. But for the whole track, it needs to average 250 kilometers an hour. And I'm supposed to find out what the average speed is for that piece of the track. Okay. So typically we're going to be using things in meters. So I think my first step is going to be to convert all of these velocities into meters per second as opposed to kilometers per hour. So if I do that, I've got 250,000 meters, and in 1 hour, that's what it is, kilometers per hour, and in 1 hour, I've got 3600 seconds. So you can see the kilo and lots of those thousands cancel out. So I've got 250 divided by 3.6. meters per second. So 250, 3.6, 69.44. And on the other hand here, I've got 230 kilometers per hour. Maybe I'll do this one a little bit longer. There are 100 meters in a kilometer, and in 1 hour, they're 3600 seconds. So once again, it's going to be 230 divided by 3.6. Which is 63.89 meters a second. Okay, so that's just a starting point. All that does is get me in a consistent set of units. So how much time, what's the clock going to have to read at the end of this race if I achieve my goal? So what I know is that velocity is the change in position divided by the change in time. So if I want the time to complete this mission, I need to to divide the velocity into the position. So the time it takes to complete this thing, if I succeed, is going to be the 600 meters divided by the 69.44 meters per second.
Is it not 1600 meters?
Oh, is it 1600? Ooh, okay. I've started to write this, so why don't I, except the answer, it does. So at this point, it's pretty easy to change. Does somebody have their book present that has the comma in there or something? It is 1600? Yes? Okay. Okay, so we got 1600 meters. Makes more sense. That was 600 meters, pretty short for a race. Okay, and what we get is 23.04 seconds. So I need to get done when the clock reads 23.04 seconds. How much time have I used up to get to this point? Well, it's the same process, right? The time is going to be the distance that I've traveled divided by my speed. I've gone 800 meters at a speed that is 63.89 meters per second. So I've got 800 meters, and that turns out to be 12.52 seconds. So I have to complete this last little bit in 12.52 seconds off of the 23.04 that I have available. So that turns out to be 10.52 seconds. So I have to do that last 800 meters in 10.52 seconds. So my velocity needs to be 800 meters divided by 10.52 seconds. Which is, is this reasonable? Yeah, 76.06 meters per second. Now, just a minute, that's not a good answer yet because probably my speedometer is calibrated in kilometers per hour, right? So that's really what I want to know. So I want to unit convert that in a second.
Okay, I have a silly question.
No, you don't.
Okay, this is oversimplifying this, but if we went half 230 and the average of the whole has to be 250, can't we say that the second half you have to do an average speed of 270 and then convert that to meters per second?
Mm-hmm. Let's see if it works out. So that's the answer you're proposing.
Yeah.
We'll see. So if I unit convert this, right, we need in 1 kilometer, there are 1,000 meters, and it takes 3,600 seconds to give me an hour. So if I multiply my 70.06 by 3.6, what do I get? Not this. I get 273.81, which I might call 274. Okay, so why did it not work? It kind of makes sense that you go high, you go low. And I'm not sure what the best answer to this. There are a whole lot of tricky math questions that work exactly the same way, basically with whether the rate is in the denominator or the numerator. And turns out that very frequently the average isn't the average if things are in the numerator. So you can see that the time ended up that we were dealing with ended up being in the numerator as opposed to the denominator. I'm not sure I'm happy with that explanation, but very common that to make up math questions that seem like the average should work, and it doesn't. So let's kind of work it the other way. So let's say, just to make numbers convenient, let's say I go 100 miles an hour, or excuse me, 100 meters, and I do the first run at 10 meters a second, and I do the next run at 20 meters a second. What's my average speed? So I do half at 10 and half at 20. Kind of sounds like the average should be 15, right? Is it going to work out that way? Well, 10 meters a second, if I need to go 10 meters, this is going to take me 10 seconds. Here I'm going 20 meters a second. It's only going to take me 5 seconds to do that 100 meters. So my average velocity is going to be 200 meters divided by 15 seconds. And when we crank that out, it's not going to be 15. 13.33. So let's do the problem a different way. So let's say instead of going the distance of 100 meters, let's say I go 10 meters a second for 10 seconds, and then I go 20 meters a second for 10 seconds. What's my average speed now? Okay, so if I go 10 seconds at 100 meters a second, I'm going to go 100 meters. If I go at 20 meters a second, 10 seconds, then I'm going to go 200 meters. So overall, I've gone 300 meters in 20 seconds, which is 15 meters a second. Okay, so sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. When we're dealing with times, equal times, then it's working. When we're working with equal distances, then it isn't working. So you got to be a little bit careful of just applying averages to average. More questions? I have one more on my list, don't I? That was 15. Did I finish my list? So let's take a look at one other sort of question, a quasi-numerical question. Let's say that this is the graph of velocity versus time. So what this graph says is that for the first second, I was going 30 centimeters a second. Then I rested. I didn't do anything for a second. And then I went with a negative velocity of 20 meters a second for 3 seconds. What does the graph of position versus time look like if this is the set of velocity versus time? Okay, so first thing to recognize is the velocity tells you the slope. So here I have a constant positive slope. Here I have a constant negative slope, and here I have zero slope. So roughly speaking, the answer has to look kind of like this, right? Positive slope, no slope, negative slope. And really the only question is, what exactly are those slopes? Where exactly are those positions? So if I go for 1 second, 30 centimeters a second, then what I'm going to end up with here is going to be 30 centimeters. And of course, I'm not moving during the next second. Where am I going to end up with after 5 seconds? Well, so I'm starting at 30 centimeters, and I'm going to go at a backward speed of 20 meters a second for 3 seconds. So I'm going to go backwards 20 centimeters per second for 3 seconds. I'm going to go back 60 centimeters. So I'm going to go here at 5 seconds. I'm going to be at minus 30. Okay. So let's spend the last 5 minutes thinking about a real important special case, which is the case of constant acceleration. So let's say that the graph of acceleration versus time is some constant. What does the graph of velocity versus time look like? It has to have a constant positive slope, right? So it has to go kind of like that. So the equation of a line, I'm not sure how you memorized it. Y equals mx plus b is kind of what I was told. What we'll be using a lot is a plus bx. But this is the y-intercept. Let me call it v naught. And the slope had to be the acceleration. So the velocity has to be the initial velocity times the slope, which is the acceleration times time. What does the graph of position versus time look like? Well, it has to have constantly increasing slope, so it has to look roughly like that. What exactly does it look like? Well, so for any particular time, the extra distance that we go has to be the area of that figure, that trapezoid. Right? So x minus the initial position has to be that area. Now, what's the area of a trapezoid? Well, it's in this section here, but it kind of makes sense. What we would, if this were a rectangular piece, we would take the height times the base. But here we have different heights, and all we have to do is average them. So the base here, that's some time t, and if we average these two, we start with v0, and this one here is at v0 plus at divided by 2. So if we just work that out, we've got t times 2 v0s plus at all divided by 2. So that's v0 times t plus 1/2 a, and then there are two t's, t squared. So these equations are going to play a big role in what we're talking about on Wednesday and what the quiz is going to be on Friday. And there's one other equation, there are actually two other equations that I like, but there's one other I want to mention now, and that has to do with the average. So when is it that this average thing kind of works? And what is true is if we have constant acceleration, then the distance we've traveled divided by the time, that turns out to be the same thing as the initial velocity plus the final velocity divided by 2. Okay, so for constant acceleration, the averaging game. We can average by just taking the beginning and final speeds and dividing by 2, or if we want, we can take the distance we've traveled and divide it by the total time. They give us exactly the same answer. Okay, so we'll talk lots more about this on Wednesday.